Today is Claudio Perini, who will speak about coherent spin networks.
Okay. So thank you all for being here in this International Quantum Gravity Seminar. I will speak about coherent spin networks, which is a new work made in collaboration with Eugenio Bianchi and Elena Magliaro. We just made the replacement on the archives yesterday. There is a new version with some improvements and some action. This is what we have done, and it's also the plan of this talk. So we introduced a proposal of coherent state for loop quantum gravity via heat kernel technique, and the labels of these coherent states are the ones are exactly the ones used in spin form semi-classical calculations. The set of these labels can be used also as an SL2C element, and for this reason they coincide with Riemann's complexifier coherent state with a suitable choice of complexifier and suitable choice of the heat kernel time. Then we study the properties of semi-classicality of these states and find, surprisingly, that they reproduce a superposition of spins with nodes labeled by Lewis speciale coherent intertwiners, and the weight associated to spins is a Gaussian with a phase, as originally proposed by Rovelli. We show also that these states have good semi-classical properties. For example, they reproduce the classical value of the volume when we compute the expectation value of the volume operator. Then we show the coherent properties of these states and introduce also through these states the holomorphic representation for loop quantum gravity. In the end, we have a discussion, and there is a slide of conclusions. So we start talking about the semi-classical calculations in spin forms. A key ingredient in these semi-classical calculations.
So we're in slide 3 now, right?
Yeah, slide 3, sorry. A key ingredient in the semi-classical calculations in spin forms are the semi-classical states, which are fixed on a prescribed intrinsic and extrinsic geometry of space. The original idea of Rovelli was to take a superposition of spins of spin network states with a very simple answer for the weight associated to each link. That is a Gaussian with a mean value J naught and a variance sigma naught, and a phase psi. The spin J naught is the classical value of the area of the surface cut by the link, and the angle psi is the variable conjugate, in a sense, to the spin, and is interpreted as the four-dimensional dihedral angle coding the extrinsic curvature. The dispersion sigma naught is chosen to be given by to scale as a power of J naught, where the power is between 0 and 2, so that this is required in order to have in the large spin limit vanishing relative uncertainties, both for the spin variable and the angle psi variable. Those kinds of states are the ones that were used for the calculation with the Bar-Kramer spin form model. But on the other hand, Rovelli and Speciale introduced an ansatz for the semi-classical tetrahedron, which is similar to the previous Gaussian, but now the superposition is over virtual links labeling virtual spins labeling the nodes. And this is the superposition, the weight, which is always a Gaussian with mean value key naught and phase phi. The virtual spin is picked over this classical value K naught and represents classically the three-dimensional dihedral angle between two faces of a tetrahedron. And the phase phi, as showed by Rovelli and Speciale, is required in order to pick all the dihedralingos in the tetrahedron to be the right one. So next slide, slide 4. Okay, so the Rovelli Speciale semiclassical tetrahedron can be also introduced with a sort of top-down derivation through the mathematical theory of coherent states for SU2. In fact, a coherent state for SU2 is defined as the eigenvector of the components of the angular momentum along a direction along a unit vector n with eigenvalue j. There are many eigenvectors satisfying these equations, so there is a phase ambiguity given by the replacement of a solution to equation 3 with given by adding a phase, an arbitrary phase to the original state. So there is this phase ambiguity. The coherent states of SU2 minimize the uncertainty relation, the equation 4. Now, Livina Speciale constructed coherent intertwiners and valence, so for arbitrary valence, in the following way. They took a tensor product of coherent states and projected them onto the gauge invariant subspace, and this projection here in equation 5 is implemented via group averaging. So it's interesting to compute the components of these coherent intertwiners on the usual virtual spin basis, and these are the components, the phi equation 6, which are given so by a contraction of the usual virtual spin intertwiners Vi, labeled by the virtual spin I, with the tensor product of the coherent state. When the valence of the node is 4, the coefficient 6 of the Livin Speciale coherent intertwiners reproduce exactly the Rovelli Speciale ansatz in the large spin limit. So they are essentially the same thing, at least in the asymptotic regime. So the states 5, the Livin Speciale coherent intertwiners, have good semiclassical properties. For example, if we compute with them the expectation value of the volume operator, which acts at the node, it reproduces exactly the volume, the classical volume of the tetrahedron, plus corrections. Next slide. So here we want to review briefly the states that I, Eugenio, and Elena used for the calculation of the Gridon propagator with the new spin form models, which are constructed putting together the Rovelli ansatz for the superposition of spins and the Livin Speciale coherent intertwiners. So the new spin form models give non-trivial dynamics to the intertwiners degrees of freedom. And to test the semiclassical limit, we can use a state with a Gaussian weight associated to spins, the Rovelli ansatz, and the nodes labeled by Livin Speciale intertwiners. So our candidate semiclassical state is this one, psi, equation 8. And, okay, recall also our definition of quantum gravity propagator, which is the connected two-point function of electric flux operators. We omit the indices for to simplify the notation. And we have an electric flux operator acting at two different nodes of a graph. And this is the definition. And we're interested in this expression for large spins. More precisely, for large semi-classical spin J0. So with the state 8, we can compute this two-point function. And we found that at least for a single force simplex, for a single spin from vertex, we found that in the large J0 limit with gamma J0 fixed, the following behavior for the two-point function. So we found the correct scaling with a distance And surprisingly, we found also a matrix M of which are the tensorial, which constitutes the tensorial structure of the propagator, which matches exactly with the tensorial structure of the standard propagator of perturbative quantum gravity. So we showed, at least in this simplified model, that we can overcome the problem of the bias crystal model. So the first question we put forward now is, can we find the top-down derivation of the states given here in equation 8? So this is not only for aesthetic reason, but also because with the top-down derivation we can have new understandings and also for practical calculations, as it happened, for example, for the coherent intertwiners. So next slide.
Can I just ask something about this slide, slide 5?
Yes,
so
sure.
The state psi refers to single tetrahedron, is that right?
Yeah, no, the state psi is associated, it's supported to a 4 simplest graph.
Yeah, so a single 4 simplex though.
Yeah, it's a simple 4 simplex. Yeah, it's the boundary of, it's associated to the boundary of a 4 simplex.
But you have fixed a single 4 simplex, right? I mean, it's not you don't have a whole triangulation with a whole bunch of 4 simplexes.
It's just one 4 simplex, but with a superposition over all the quantum numbers.
Right. So in the last line, when you say, can we find a top-down derivation about state 8, is that also going to refer to single simplex, 4 simplex?
Yeah, well, that's just because to compute the propagator, for technical reason, we use the semi-classical state associated to a single 4 simplex. But the construction of this semi-classical state is general. So
if it is general, then what is J0? This is my question, really.
J0?
Yeah.
J0 is the classical value of the area associated to a link on which the spin network is fixed. So if you want, these states are general in the sense that for a general graph, we can pick those states on given areas and extrinsic curvature for each link.
So okay. So if you have a whole bunch of links, then you're just going to take a tensor product of these states? There are not going to be any correlations?
Yeah. So at the level of the superposition of the spins, there is a factorization. So we take a Gaussian for each link.
Yeah. So
but,
it's just a
well, actually there are correlations. But there is a partial factorization, but there are correlations that comes essentially from the Lewis special coherent intertwiners. Correlation spin intertwiners, sort of.
Okay, so maybe we should come back to that. But I just wanted to make sure that in the rest of the talk, are you going to be focusing on full loop quantum gravity, or are you going to be looking at just one 4 simplex?
No, for the rest of the talk, the attention on an arbitrary graph, but fixed with the nodes of arbitrary valence. So, if you want, yes, we only fix the graph. The rest is we try to find coherent states for associated to the graph, but test is fluctuating.
Okay, thank you.
Another person.
So. Next slide, slide 6. So
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Hi, John Barrett here.
John.
So in this calculation, what you really should do is use the asymptotic formula for the full simplex amplitude. Is that right?
Yes.
So your equation 8 was a bit ad hoc.
Sorry?
So your equation 8 is ad hoc.
Ad hoc. Ad hoc. Yes, equation 8 is ad hoc in the sense, yes, it's ad hoc, but it's not the proposal that I want to speak about this talk. This is a proposal we made in a previous paper to do the calculation of the propagator. But now we are going to find a more top-down derivation of the state.
Okay.
So this is Carlo.
Hello.
To derive 10, there are two ingredients. One is equation 8, and the other is the vertex that you're referring to.
Ah.
Okay. But so the main ingredient is a vertex, and it's asymptotic. In fact, the results that Claudio is mentioning relies heavily on your asymptotic result.
Right.
Okay. So, but not just that. Is one ingredient is the vertex, and one ingredient is your asymptotic result for the vertex, and then there is also a boundary state, and the boundary state is 8. So these are different ingredients.
I see. Right. Okay, good.
Yes. Okay. So slide 6. So this slide is about the canonical framework. And within the canonical framework, Thiemann and collaborators have strongly advocated the use of complexifier coherent states. When these states are restricted to a single graph, they are labeled by an SS2C element, a rich link. Their thickness properties have been studied in detail. However, the geometric interpretation of the SL2C labels and the relation with the states used in spin forms remained unexplored. Moreover, Thiemann and Flori concluded these two things. I'm quoting here. So, coherent states whose complexifiers are squares of area operators are not appropriate tool with which to analyze the semiclassical properties of volume operators. And second, the expectation value of the volume operator with respect to coherent states, depending on a graph with only invariant vertices, reproduces its classical value at the phase space point at which the coherent state is picked only if n equals 6. So only for 6 valent, they say that only 6 valent coherent states have good semiclassical properties. So these statements contributed to increase the tension between the canonical and the covariant frameworks. So the second question we put forward here is, can we understand the origin of this tension? We will see that answering the first question and the second question is quite the same thing. The two questions are strictly correlated. Next slide. Slide 7. So we review here the construction of the usual coherent states for a single particle in quantum mechanics with heat kernel techniques. Consider the heat kernel of the Hilbert space of a single particle over Rn, which is defined by equation 11 as the heat kernel evolution applied to the Dirac delta distribution. And t is the heat kernel time. The phase space of the particle in Rn is R2n, which can be viewed as the complexification of the abelian group Rn, which is Cn. Consider now the unique analytical continuation of the heat kernel with respect to the variable x prime. This analytical continuation defines the family of wave functions 12. These wave functions are coherent in the following mathematical sense. First, they are annihilated by annihilation operator z, which is x plus itp. X is the position and pi is the momentum operator. And two, they saturate the Heisenberg center t relation. And three, they form an overcomplete basis of the Hilbert space, which is given by this representation of the delta function, equation 13. So next slide. Brian Hall generalized the previous construction in the case where the configuration space is the group manifold SU2. In this case, and also in the previous case, of course, the coherent states are associated with the generalization of the Seagal-Bergmann transform to Lie groups, and I will talk about it later. So consider on the group SU2 the Laplace-Beltrami operator associated to the unique B-invariant metric. Then apply, as before, the heat kernel evolution to the Dirac delta distribution of the group, equation 14. And then, as before, we take the analytic continuation with respect to the group variable H prime. Now we have wave functions, which are labeled by an element in the complexification of SU2, which is SLQC. So we have the wave function 15. Being SU2 simply connected, the complexification of SU2 is defined simply via exponentiation of the complexification of its Lie algebra. The equation 15, the state 15, can be thought as the state 15 can be thought as an SUG loop state associated to a loop gamma, the group element G being the holonomy along gamma. And so it has the following Peter Weil expansion in SU2 irreducible representations, equation 16, where chi is the trace in the representation J. Next slide, 9. So consider now a general graph gamma. Our proposal for coherent spin networks is the following. Consider the gauge invariant projection of a product over links of heat kernels. Equation 17. So we have a product of heat kernels K. And we are integrating, for each node, we are doing the gauge invariant projection by group averaging. So this notation of equation 17 refers to a complete graph. That is, each node is labeled by a number A, and each link is labeled by a couple of numbers, AB, just for convenience. So these states 17 are the coherent states associated to the Seagal-Bergmann transform for theories of connections already introduced by Ashtega, Lewandowski, Maroff, Maurao, Tiemann in 1994. But we discovered them following completely different path. So our proposal consists in give the SLQC labels and geometrical interpretation and fix the heat kernel time in terms of the other labels in order to recover the semi-elastical limit. So the main observation is the following, that every SLQC element can be written in terms of a positive real number eta, two unit vectors, n prime, and an angle psi. So the classical interpretation is the following. The unit vector n is the unit flux of the electric field through a surface intersected by the link, as viewed from the first node. N prime is the flux viewed from the second node. And finally, eta, the positive parameter eta, is related to the modulus of the electric field, namely to the area of the surface. And these are exactly the labels used in spin forms. Next slide. 10. So an element in SLQC can be written in terms of a positive real number at two SU2 group elements, G and G tilde, in this way, equation 19. In turn, an SU2 group element can be uniquely written in terms of an angle phi tilde and the unit vector n once we choose a phase convention. Mathematically, it's a section of the Hopf fiber bundle. Let us define the unit vector n via its inclination at azimuth, equation 12, and then introduce the associated group elements n in SU2, defined by equation 21. Then a general SU2 group element is given by n times the exponential of beta tau 3, where tau 3 is the diagonal generator of SU2. And using such parameterization, we finally find the expression 22 for the SL2C group element. So we have, okay, the following expression, where there is a complex number zeta, which is whose a real part is xi, and the imaginary part is eta. And xi is defined as the difference beta minus beta tilde. So this was for a single link, but when we consider the full graph, we have the full set of labels, equation 23. Okay, eta n, there is nab and nba, which are different labels. One is viewed from the first node, and the other is viewed from the other node. And so we have, for each link, an area and an angle, labeling the link. And then we have, for each node, a set of B unit vectors, where B is the valence of the node. Next slide. So what we have just found is this remarkable correspondence between the Lorentz group and the classical geometric labels used in spin forms, equation 24. These are the labels of the states used in our answers for the definition of the semi-classical two-point function, but we can ask if it is only a coincidence. On the other hand, we have the recent work by Speziale and Friedel, where they show that there is a map from the cotangent bundle of SU2 to the set of labels we just introduced. And they prove that this map is a symplectomorphism with the natural symplectic structure on the cotangent bundle SU2 and the natural, in fact, unique symplectic structure on the label space. In particular, this is important, the area eta and the angle psi, which codes part of the extrinsic curvature, are canonically conjugate. But notice that equation 26, that the cotangent bundle of SU2 is isomorphic to SL2C. So it follows that the map we have constructed and the map that Friedel and Speziale constructed are actually the same. The big surprise comes in the next slide, where we compute the asymptotics of the covariant spin networks we introduced in a particular link.
I'm sorry, but I still am confused about the global issues that I already raised in Beijing. Equation 25 that just doesn't make sense to me still, because on the left-hand side, you have got a manifold, which is S3 cross R3. On the right-hand side, you have got a manifold, which is R2 cross S2 cross S2. And they're not even diffeomorphic to each other. So how could they be symplectomorphic to each other?
Yeah, there is, I think, a subtlety, maybe Simone can answer. I think that the it's not relevant. I think it's from the fact that the symplectic form is degenerate. Is that Simone? So you have to take divide by the kernel of the symplectic form, and then the resulting space is essentially the same as the potential bubble SU2. There is also the subtlety because the correspondence is actually 1 to 2, but they are essentially the same. We can maybe discuss later also with Simone if you want.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the next slide is 12. So if we take a covariant spin network and expand it in the usual spin network basis, labeled by spins, and for each link, and labeled by virtual spins associated to nodes, we get equation 27, where the coefficients of these expansions are the S. So these coefficients have the following form, equation 28, where pi j is the representation matrix in the j representation, and as before, this on the right, this bi are the usual intertwiners of recoupling theory, so the labeled by virtual spins. And okay, these are the coefficients. What we are interested in the asymptotics of this expression for large eta. So the crucial observation is that in this limit, we have the following asymptotic behavior for the matrix representation. So equation 29 tells us that the representation of spin J of this SL2C element, which is the exponential of Z tau 3, is a diagonal matrix. But notice that on the right, there is the presence of this delta, Kronecker delta, of MJ, which actually projects on the highest magnitude number. This delta says that M should be equal to J in the asymptotic limit. So therefore, introducing the projector P plus on the highest magnetic number, we can write the representation 29 in the following compact form, equation 30. So the matrix representation pi of this group element, SL2C group element, in the asymptotic regime is proportional to the projector onto the highest magnetic number. This projection is the key for the link with the coherent states of SU2, and hence with the living special intertwiners. SU2 coherent states, in fact, are defined as the rotations of the highest magnetic number states. Next slide. 13. The next step is to notice this identity, 31, so that defining J naught and sigma naught variants in this way, equation 32, in terms of the labels of SL2C, we find the following asymptotics for the coherent spin networks, equation 33. So this is the main result, these asymptotics here, and you can see that these are exactly the states that Elena, Eugenio, and Guy considered as boundary semiclassical states in the analysis of the graviton propagator. But now they are general. They are for an arbitrary graph and for nodes of arbitrary valence. In particular, the intertwiners, we can see, that are the living speciale ones, thanks to the projection onto the highest magnetic number. The parameter xi, the parameter psi, in the calculation of the propagator, were chosen so to reproduce the extrinsic curvature. So also in this more general context, psi must be interpreted as an extrinsic angle, as originally proposed by Rovelli. This result confirms the geometrical interpretation of our variables and extends the validity of the semiclassical states used in spin forms well beyond the simplicial setting, because coherent spin networks are defined now in full loop quantum gravity.
Are your graphs all four valent or what?
Yes. General, yeah.
Oh, they don't have to be four valent. You could have a five valent vertex.
Yes, the valence is general.
Okay.
Yeah. Next slide, 14. So, in order to strengthen our geometrical interpretation, we can compute expectation values of observables and see what happens. So, in the large eta limit, the expectation value of the area operator is easily computed and gives exactly the area spectrum of loop quantum gravity with the semiclassical value of the area computed on the semiclassical value of the area. This confirms the interpretation of eta as the quantity that prescribes the expectation value of the area. The Wilson loop operator acts on the basis vectors in the following way. Chi is the trace of the economy, equation 35. And using this, we find the simple result that the expectation value of the Lonely operator is two times the cosinus of psi hat, with this factor depending on its kernel time. Therefore, we can see that in the limit of the kernel time going to zero, compatible with eta large, the parameter psi can be interpreted as the conjugacy class of the group element H0 where the Asteger-Barbero connection is picked on. Similarly, we can compute the dispersions of these operators and find these simple relations, 37 and 38. If we require also that the relative dispersions of the error operator and the Wilson loop operators vanish in the large J0 limit, this fixes also the following scaling. So the kernel time should be should scale as a power of J0, and this power should be between 0 and 1. Next slide, 15.
I'm sorry, but so far you have kept sigma not completely arbitrary, or is it a given function of the classical J0 still, or what is happening?
Sigma naught is recognized by equation 31. It's defined as the variance of the Gaussian, that because in the large eta limit, these states are Gaussians, have a weight associated to links which are Gaussians. So we can identify the variance, and we define the variance by equation 32, which is in slide 13. So sigma naught is 1 over 2 the kernel time, 2t. So this is how we fix the sigma naught in terms of the SSU, in terms of the kernel time. It's just a function of the kernel time.
Sorry, but then you're taking the limit as heat kernel time goes to 0, then what happens to sigma naught? It becomes infinite.
Yes. In fact, the state we used in the semi-classical calculation in font are exactly like this. So the mean value is large, but also the variance is large, but we require that the relative dispersion is vanishing. So the variance, if you want, the width of the Gaussian goes as a lower power with respect to the mean value.
Okay.
This is actually the regime identifying the spin form calculation in order to make things work, I would say.
We are not taking a t to zero limit.
Yeah, we're not taking a t going to zero limit. We're fixing t in terms of the SL2C labels, and then we are taking the J0 limit as in spin form, in a sense.
Yeah, but I'm still confused about 38, about these limits. I'm sorry about slowing you down. But if I look at 39 now, there t is, you're telling me how t is behaving, right? The t is now, is related to this J0, which is what the question that I was asking.
Yes. It's because sigma naught also is related to J0. So we can fix, for example, sigma naught as J0, for example.
Yeah, so that was the question I was asking.
A common choice is that, in the literature, is that sigma naught is equal to J0, but this is the variance, so that the width is the square root of J0. And that's because vanishing,
I'm trying to understand it from your general considerations or whatever principles you want to use.
Maybe
there are unique coherent states, or there is a lot of still difference. And it seems to me that there is a freedom because of a choice of this k, which can go from 0 to 1.
Yes. I think the only freedom we found is in this in the choice of the heat kernel time in terms of the SL2C labels. Yes. There is this ambiguity.
So if t is getting large, then sigma naught is getting small. Is that right?
Sigma is getting large because t is getting smaller. Sigma naught is getting large, and j naught also is getting large.
But if j naught is getting large, then t is getting large.
No, t is getting smaller.
Well, that's not consistent with j naught getting large.
It's
a mistake somewhere.
This is exactly the kind of thing that I'm confused about,
So t should go as j naught to the minus k, is that right?
So no, the heat kernel time is getting small.
Right, so 39 is wrong.
The main point is that the ratio between J naught and the width of the Gaussian is getting smaller. That's the main point. That's okay. The regime which we identified and it makes the contact with spinforms.
Okay.
So the key point is that the relative dispersion is vanishing, even if the variance is going to is getting large.
There's a typo. G zero to minus.
Oh, is that right? That is what is confusing us all. Is that a typo? That's a key point for us.
That's a typo 39, yeah. Sorry.
This is the whole, my confusion started from here. Okay. So 39 is a typo, J naught to the minus K.
Yes, to the minus K, yes.
Ah, okay. Sorry. That was the whole.
I'm sorry. Okay, so maybe we can pass to the next slide, which is 15. Okay, so this slide is about coherent properties of these things, which are quite well known, but we have written them explicitly here. So first property is that the coherent states are eigenstates of the annihilation operator associated to a link, where the annihilation operator is defined in equation 40. A is the area operator, and H is the Ohlone operator. Two. The coherent spin networks saturate the associated Heisenberg relations, the Heisenberg relation associated to these annihilation operators. And third, they form an all-complete basis. So the point 3 is very important because it means that every SQG state can be expressed as a superposition of states with semiclassical labels. Of course, coherent spin networks do not have in general a semiclassical interpretation unless some constraints on their labels are satisfied. For example, the closure condition between the normals at each node and the gluing constraints in order to have a Regge interpretation of the state. The resolution of the identity, we give it this resolution only for a loop state, but actually is general, is given by equation 41 in terms of this representation of the delta distribution. And the measure d nu is related to the R measure over SL2C by a simple relation, which is equation 42. So dH in equation 42 is the R measure of SL2C. And omega H is the so-called SL2 average heat kernel of SL2C. So we take the heat kernel of SL2C and take an SL2 average. We can pass to next slide, 15. These properties of coherent states lead naturally to an holomorphic representation for loop quantum gravity. For example, consider a single copy of SU2 in order to simplify the notation. We can see that the scalar product in the Hilbert space associated to SU2 defines a correspondence between a state in this Hilbert space and an holomorphic function defined by equation 43, so a function of an SL2C element which associates to this SL2C element the scalar product with a coherent state. But there is more, because this correspondence is a unitary map. So from the Hilbert space S2 or SU2 with the R measure of SU2 to the space of square integrable functions and holomorphic over SL2C with a measure constructed with the R measure of over SL2C and SU2 average heat kernel omega. To be the more explicit, this average heat kernel is defined by equation 45. We have this group averaging over SU2, and ST is the heat kernel over SL2C. So, in a sense, omega T can be viewed also as the heat kernel over SL2C divided by SU2. What is now available is a representation, so already known from Arteaga et al. In 1994, for loop quantum gravity, where the states are holomorphic functions of classical variables, H, that now admit a clear geometrical interpretation in terms of areas, extrinsic angles, and normals. So the parameters eta, the two normals, and psi, which are the variables generally used in the spin form setting. Next slide. So, we have discussed a proposal of coherent states for loop quantum gravity and shown that in a specific limit, they reproduce the states used in the spin form framework. These states coincide with Feynman's complexifier coherent states with the natural choice of complexifier operator, a rather specific choice of its kernel time, and the clear geometrical interpretation for their SL2C labels. The negative conclusions of Feynman and Flory can be probably traced back to the fact they did not take the same semi-classical limit we consider here. It is possible that coherent spin networks can be obtained also via geometric quantization, this is a work in progress by Friedel and Speziale, and that the latter coincide with a subset of the states discussed here via its kernel methods. This would be an instance of Guillen-Mistenberg's quantization commute with reduction. Then the conclusions, next slide. So coherent spin networks are candidate semi-classical states for full quantum gravity. Given a space-time metric, for example, Minkowski or Schwarzschild, we can smear the Hasselbalch-Barbero connection on links of the graph and the electric field on surfaces dual to links. This determines a finite amount of data that can be used as labels for the coherent states. The fact that in the large spin limit they are effectively labeled by Lili Speciale coherent intertwiners guarantees, this is important, that they are actually picked on a classical expectation value of non-commuting geometrical operators, such as the volume operator. And last, a surprising property of the states we have discussed is that they bring together so many apparently conflicting ideas that have been proposed in the search for semi-classical states in loop quantum gravity, and we consider this convergence to be a measure of the robustness of the theory. Thank you.
Questions?
Well, I have a question. What a simple thing to do would be to use a Levine Speciale vertex on your graph and just fix the spin labels on the edges. Why is your procedure superior? What's more semi-classical about your procedure than doing that?
Okay. So our geometrical understanding is that if we fix the spins on the links, then we are not picking the extrinsic curvature on the correct value. So the extrinsic curvature angle is completely spread because the spin is sharp. So there should be observables that behave badly if we use these coherent states, these states. And in fact, there are. For example, the endpoint function doesn't work with the
infra. But you said that in the semi-classical limit, it's practically the same thing. Your variance is shrinking to zero as a fraction of the spin. So it really doesn't make too much difference.
No, they are totally different because coherent spin networks are not eigenstates or areas, so they can be expanded with the Peter Weyl in the representations. And you can see that the weight is a Gaussian. So it has a finite size, the Gaussian.
I see. So it's different variables.
The state with six spins, taking the variance, making the variance grow to zero, for example. But they are very different.
Okay.
More questions?
Okay, I have a couple of questions. And I have a comment. Let me begin with a comment. I think it's very, very nice that, you know, you found a geometrical interpretation of this coherent state transform that was available for 14 years. And precisely because it was all there, but on the other hand, one did not have the appropriate kind of geometrical labels to interpret those states, and I think that's why not much was done with them. So this is very, very nice.
But my first problem is really that in order to make these labels, we had to use this quote-unquote isomorphism, simple automorphism, between the cotangent bundle or SU2, which is the same as the difference to C, and this other thing that on the right-hand side, which is R2 cross S2 cross S2. And of course, I mean, this, I know that Laura and Simone have written this new paper, which I'm studying right now.
Yes.
But it would really help me to make, I want to make sure that nothing is slipped under the rug here in order to make this all very beautiful stuff, interpretation of the covariant states that were around for a while. So I really would like to understand this. If this is very difficult, I can call you later. But if it is something easy.
Wait, the thing about it is if you consider the plane without the origin. Take the plane without the origin, and now you take the symplectic form RDR wedge d theta. The symplectic form is degenerate at the origin. So now you can define the reduction of the space space by dividing by the kernel of the symplectic form at the origin. And this gives you precisely R2. So that equation should not be seen as an equivalence in strict terms, in fact. It's just that you construct a space which is pre-symplectic because it has a degenerate symplectic 2 form. You make the reduction by this symplectic 2 form, and that would be equivalent to the star of SU2.
There's a construction like this. I don't know if it's the same. I'm looking at equation 25, where you have to look at the points where n is not equal to n prime. And just by removing that diagonal, you then get equivalence.
Yeah,
is that what's going on?
There's a typo in there too, I see now. It should be the star of S1 cross S2 cross S2.
Sorry, we found the second type.
So n tilde are different, yes.
N and n prime.
Yeah, sorry, n and n prime, they're different, yes.
Yeah, so you have to remove a diagonal subset, and then the topology, I think,
completely. In fact, there's also a Z2. So even once you've done the reduction, you still are not isomorphic to the cotangent bundle of SU2. You still have to divide by an action of a Z2, which is described in the paper. But yes, it's true. There's another layer of subtlety, which is this.
Right. So now my question is the following. So you have to do these two operations on the right-hand side, right? In order to make it equal to the left-hand side. But on the other hand, it seems to me that all the labels and so on, which are basically coming on equation 24, on the same page 11, those were referring to the right-hand side. In that
now,
equation...
So let me also clarify this point, because the fact that the two papers also came about at the same time might create a bit of confusion. But in fact, it's two very different sets of coherent states. So the labels have their form, but in fact, in one case, we are using an isomorphism, which is in terms of T star of S1 times S2 times S2. In the other case, they're using SL2C. Using these two different isomorphisms gives two different natural choices of complex structures. And so two different sets of coherent states, in fact. The magic of the result is the fact that in the large, there's a notion of a certain limit, which is this large spin limit, in which actually these two sets of coherent states will turn out to be the same, and just given by the coherent intertwiners times Gaussians.
Okay, but supposing I was not taking this limit, I still would like to understand the coherent states by themselves. And if I was doing that, then it seems to me that these labels are still given by, roughly speaking, by the right-hand side of equation 25. But in order to really make it equal to the left-hand side, you had to make all this extra work, right? So let me start from scratch.
So
I think the...
Yeah. You want to add something or...
Yeah. I just want to say something, though. Namely, that... See, in this old paper with ALMMT paper, the 1994 paper,
there were these covariance states, and they really were based on this identification of T star SU2 to be SL2C, which is kind of the left-hand side of this 25 equation. Now one has a geometrical interpretation of it coming, and that is really the right-hand side of this 25 equation, using the right-hand side of 25 equation. And I just want to make sure that somehow in this geometrical interpretation, one hasn't forgotten these precise operations of leaving out some diagonal, making the identification Z to Z star, that the covariance states that you are saying, which are there, are really there, and not some further restrictions on them.
Yes. I think maybe the origin of this mismatching could be that simply a very simple thing, that, equation, if you want, 19, for example, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's that this decomposition in 19 is not unique. So there is where these geometrical labels are not a one-to-one or two correspondence. It's not an isomorphic in strict mathematical sense. We are just saying that every SL2C element can be written with some arbitrariness in terms of two normals, an angle, and a positive parameter theta. We are only saying that. And then there are ambiguities, which are essentially these choices of the faces. But we have also, in some cases, a geometrical interpretation for these choices. For example, for radial geometries and for what Simone called twisted geometries in their last paper.
So, concerning the twisted geometry, as I was saying, that is true. In constructing the coherent states for the twisted geometries, which is a different construction than the one presented here, so I just want to be super brief. It's true. One has to take into account those important aspects, such as the depth to symmetry and the fact that you have to reduce by the kernel of the symplectic form, and that's what we are doing. At the end of the day, then the states will be, in fact, different if you don't take that limit.
But I mean, how can both be? It seems to me that one of the sets is a little bit larger than the other set, and either there are relations between the covariance states that Perini has told us about today, or that there's some mismatch. And I don't want to sort of harp on it too much, but there is some unease here for me. I mean, it doesn't seem to be quite right.
But I think that. The reason why we found different coherent states, our coherent states and Simone coherent states, is not in the fact that it's not because of the correspondence between the labels, which actually I think they are the same labels, but it's in the fact that they choose a different polarization of the phase space. In order to do the quantization.
It's worth whether in your construction as well there might be some depth to symmetries and such that you have to take care of.
Exactly. And dropping some states that you think are there but aren't really there because you have to drop this diagonal.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, it may be. It may be. But since we don't do geometric quantization, for the moment we didn't care about these possible degeneracies or ambiguities, while in geometric quantization, what should be?
Okay. My second question, maybe if it's too long, again, I can call you and we can discuss later. But my second question is really this. I mean, one of the things that bugged me about Thomas Tiemann's original proposals was that there were no correlations between what was happening at one edge and the next edge and so on and so forth. And in fact, we looked at it in electrodynamics very carefully, and it does look like if one did the construction of a lot old Tiemann construction with the complexifier, then one got not the Fock space, but some a completely different representation, which did not have the Coulomb force law, etc. in it. So my question really here is that somehow, because of the intertwiner, this function phi that you have, there are some correlations between adjoining edges. And do you have any sense at all, you or Simone or Carlo, that this, in fact, these correlations are sufficient to give you the kind of long correlations that exist in the Fock vacuum.
I don't know. For the moment, we don't know. We could analyze this aspect. But what I'm sure is that if you take a coherent state.
Just to clarify, you mean kinematical correlation here? Because you're talking about just kinematical coherent state.
Yes, just kinematical coherent. Yeah.
Actually, in constructing them, this time we used a dipole graph. And then there we have seen explicitly that all the spin network is strongly correlated, each part of the spin network. So intertwiners, both two nodes are correlated, spins are correlated, it's all really strongly correlated at the kinematical level.
Okay, thank you.
Excuse me, this is Benjamin Barr from Gorham. I have a couple of comments about this state because, first of all, I would like to comment about what Professor Ashikar just said. It's true that the complexified coherent states have no correlations between the edges, but as soon as you go to the gauge invariant subspace and investigate the projections, they do. And it's those states, which are exactly the same set of presented here, that we have looked at in 2006. And one of the big problems with these states, or one of the peculiarities, which I think also lies at the foundation of the problems that arise here with, is the fact that the gauge invariant phase space is not a manifold, but it's rather an orbifold. And there are lots of points that in this prescription that has presented here are left out, I think. And this is, for instance, leads to the fact that this, although the states that are presented here look very much like Gaussian states, if you look at states that somehow are peaked on points of the orbifold which are somehow kinks or which are at the edge of the phase space, this Gaussianity property goes away. And the problem, I think, is that this has nothing to do with anything that is unphysical, but it's rather to do with configurations that have more symmetry. For instance, if you peak all the SL2-phi elements on all edges to be the same, those states are not Gaussian states, no matter how large the J is that you're choosing.
The gauge you refer to is just SU2 internal gauge?
Yes, it's SU2 gauge, yes. So there are two different things. The gauge at the level of the Hilbert space, that is, we're implementing gauge invariance at nodes, and there is the question of the redundancy of the labels, and this is a different question. So these are SL2C labels. And it seems that, I think also from various papers, that the right gauge at the level of classical phase space is SL2C to the L, to the number of links divided not by SU2 to the power of nodes, to the number of nodes, but divided by SL2C to the number of nodes.
That's exactly the set of labels that we also have used. Yes. And the problem is if you do this, then you end up with something that's not a manifold.
Yes.
So for a boundary state, are you trying to capture both the metric and the extrinsic curvature?
Yes.
Semi-classically?
Yes.
I see.
More questions?
Yes, I have a comment to Abai's question, which is Jurek. So Abai asked it about relating edges. So Abai gave an example, the example of the Fock state, which was introduced by Madhavan. And in that case, this relation comes about because that the complexifier operator is not simply the sum of Laplacians, but it is some operator which is defined more globally. So this generalized Laplacian has cross terms which contain derivatives, products of derivatives, associated to different edges. So in order to have this relation Abba is asking about, we should consider different complexifiers. And whereas what Benjamin said, he just said that when we make sure that the states are gauge invariant, then they are not simply just simple tensor products or functions, but there are some advertisements. This projection on gauge invariant subspace creates some relations between the edges which meet at vertices. Okay, but I also have a question to the speaker. So in our coherent state transform, which in this paper of 1994, which was mentioned, there was one more ingredient. Namely, we needed some measure of length of edges. So in order to define this transform simultaneously for all possible graphs, and to make sure that this transform consistently defined for all those graphs, we needed to have some measure of length. So for every edge, that measure would assign to every edge contained in manifold number, and this number was positive and had natural properties of the length. So if edge was split into two edges, then the corresponding length would add to the length assigned to the bigger edge. So this length was additive. So do you see? Do you use this kind of extra structure here? Do you need it?
At all? No. For the moment, we attention single piece graph and. We did not attempt to analyze, to do some semi-classical analysis in this more complicated case where there is some other graphs where we don't know at the moment. So, future work.
Okay, thanks.
More questions?
Yes, I have another question to the speaker. The coherent state, as you have written them down here, is the part which looks like a Gaussian in the J0 and in the Xi, as far as I understand, and some part which is the Levinas-Viscali intertwiner. So in order to have a geometric interpretation for those ends, those four vectors have to satisfy the closure condition. But in order to do so, you also need the lengths which are given by the J's, but you're summing over lots of J's. So I would like to ask what the geometric interpretation of these states are then.
Okay. If I can
make an advertisement, is the twisted geometries. As we show in that paper, it is true, because you are lacking the gluing conditions, the geometric interpretation is not in terms of rigid geometries, but in terms of a looser notion of geometry, which is associated with this phase space of loop quantum gravity, and which we dub twisted geometries. But it's true. The gluing conditions are not interpreted, so you shouldn't think of these as regi geometries.
Maybe like discontinuous geometry, classical level. But
okay, thank you.
More questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.